Great. Well, thanks very much, and thanks for the kind introduction, and thanks so much for the invitation. This is, I think, a remarkable conference to see this many people come together to focus on this issue in Canada. The organizers are to be congratulated, and I'm really delighted to have been asked to participate. So about 2 months ago, I got an email from organizers of this website, Republic, Reimagining Democracy, in which they asked if I'd be willing to submit to a short question and answer session, which they then post on the website. And I said that I would. And I think they were actually responding to a piece that I did on open access that appeared in some of the Canadian papers I write for, as well as the BBC, which may have been where they found it. And they asked me a whole series of questions, and there's one question in particular that I want to talk about and use as the basis for today's talk. The question was, do I think that access to content is enough for democratization of knowledge? And my response, in part, was, I don't think it's sufficient, but it may well be necessary. Now, I wish I would have rephrased that a little bit, but the key point behind the comment was that I think open access is, as the title suggests, necessary but not sufficient. I have to say that the response that I got back from the organizers of the website was, well, it's a bit short. Would you like to expand a little bit on your answer? And it was more than just this, but it wasn't that much more, I'll admit. And things were busy at the time, and I said, you know, to be honest, it kind of spells out what I want to say, and you've got links to a number of other documents. That's about what I can provide. But I'm going to give you a different answer. Because what I want to do in today's talk is actually respond to that question. Can I expand a little bit on that? And I have both a short answer and a long answer. I'll start with the short answer and then, not surprisingly, spend most of my time with the long answer. And the short answer is this. This is Lucy Maud Montgomery, one of our best known authors. And she's, of course, best known for Anne of Green Gables. She's somewhat less well known for some other works that she wrote, private works. In fact, 10 volumes of unpublished works that, as I say, have never been published. That's why they're unpublished, or diaries and the like. Now, several years ago, those works were about to come into the public domain. So Lucy Maud died at a period of time such that there was a provision within the Copyright Act that said that all unpublished works of authors who died during this given period of time would, 50 years later, let's say, come into the public domain. And her works were amongst the works, alongside several former prime ministers and premiers and, you know, dozens of notable Canadians whose works were about to come into the public domain. Well, there was an effort by heirs of Lucy Maud Montgomery to try to change that, and they pushed very hard for an extension of the term of copyright, not for all copyright, that's a fight yet to come. In this instance, it was an extension of the term of copyright just for these unpublished works. And so it was a piece of legislation that I think I dubbed the Lucy Maud Montgomery Copyright Term Extension Act, because it was ostensibly about all these unpublished works, but it was really being driven by the heirs of Lucy Maud. Now, they gathered in the government brought together the heirs along with a few other stakeholders, frankly, in a room far smaller than this, and actually negotiated out an agreement where they said that they would extend the term of copyright by an additional 18 years. No real consultation, simply a series of groups coming together and saying that would be the extension. Once it got through the parliamentary process, though, a number of people caught wind of this, objected, and it actually never did pass. And so those volumes of works are now in the public domain. Yet if you want to access them, the sole place that you'll find them is here, at the University of Guelph, which has the Lucy Maud Montgomery collection. Now, if the heirs were ever to take those works and publish them, they would indeed be in the public domain, and we would all be free to use them as we can any other works that are in the public domain. But as it stands today, you can't. In fact, you can't even find these unpublished works unless you go to the University of Guelph and seek permission to have access to those works. They certainly aren't going to give you permission to republish those works, but you could, in theory, go to their library and have access to them. To me, this illustrates, in a sense, why the public domain is necessary, but frankly, not always sufficient. The works are available, the law or the contracts in theory say that we have access and there is no control, yet in the case of Lucy Maud, there is clearly control. I think the same is true for many elements of open access. We can get the contracts right, we can get even the mandates that comes from funding agencies right, but there remains within that broader environment a whole series of other issues that at the end of the day, if the goal is to ensure this democratization of knowledge, in the words of the Republic website, there is, I believe, more to be done. It is necessary but not sufficient. That's the short answer in the illustration. Let me give you the longer answer, though, and say and illustrate not just why it's necessary but not sufficient, but why it is critically important, I think, for people in many communities, particularly this community. We were just chatting before the talk about how this was a community that truly has some has a vested interest and an energy in these issues that you don't typically find. And I think there is an opportunity for this community to become very involved in the in that broader scope of issues. So for the longer answer, I got to go back to Internet 1997, or back to 1997, back when we were told John Walensky thought that PKP would just be a project for a number of months. Now, at the time, I had to cheat a little bit. The Public Knowledge Project didn't quite look like this. This is from 2001. Peter Suber's site looked like this, though, back in 1997. He advises, interestingly, the site is still expanding. Please visit again when I have more to show you. He was true to his word. So that's what that's part of what the internet looked like back in 1997. This is roughly the same time. This was the time of Netscape, Netscape Navigator, where you could download that browser. This is what Yahoo looked like back when this was literally their homepage, and it was merely little more than just a directory. The CBC's website back in 1997 looked something like this. It too has thankfully improved. And Google looked like this. It was literally just a Stanford research project with links from Larry Page and Sergey Brin, and wasn't anything what we know it to be today. Well, that's what the internet looked like back in 1997. And when you think back to that time, and particularly when you think back to that time from a law and policy perspective, the prevailing meme was something along the lines of hands off the internet. The view was that the public sector, that the private sector could lead, that government was too Luddite, too slow, too out of it when it came to these issues to get involved. And so the mantra consistently, whether in this country here in Canada or in the United States or pretty much around the world, was stay away, government. You don't get this area. There isn't a role for you to play. But if you peel back the onion a little bit and you take a closer look at what was actually happening, there was actually a pretty significant role for government to play. And it was playing that role even at that time. So here in this country, and I know we've got people from around the world, but to give you a Canadian sense, we launched all around this time the SchoolNet project, the goal to ensure that every school from coast to coast to coast would have internet access, and Canada was proud to say it was the first country to achieve that about 2 years before any other country in the world. We had, back in 1997, Canada preparing for an OECD ministerial conference on electronic commerce hosted in Ottawa in 1998. And as part of that, we had the federal government active on a whole range of policy issues, these being the speaking notes from then Industry Minister John Manley introducing private sector privacy legislation for Canada. We also developed a cryptography policy back at that time, a policy that put us ahead of a number of other countries in terms of freeing the ability for those that produce encryption technologies to export those technologies out of the country. There was work taking place across the country to develop electronic commerce legislation and e-commerce legislation in this case to provide contractual certainty certainly for those businesses, but also for consumers who might contract online and know that those contracts that they might enter into would be binding. Following from that, a number as the years start to progress, you had the internet sales template developed by the provinces to create consumer protection legislation for electronic commerce put into place by many provinces across the country. A little further along, you get the principles for electronic authentication developed by the government, and then more recently, a project I was involved with, a national task force to focus on spam. This was the task force report calling for anti-spam legislation. The government has yet to move in that direction, but nevertheless recognized at least there was a role to at least think about some of these policy issues. So there has been this consistent role throughout. Now, if we're going to talk about where we ought to be going and the things we ought to be thinking about, I'd argue that we need to be thinking not about that Internet 1997, but rather Internet 2007, with the view of thinking about what the internet might look like, say Internet 2017, when we have the 11th annual version of this conference, and we reflect back not on 10 years, but instead on 20. Well, as you know, as you all know, part of, and has been hearing about, part of Internet 2007 is the amazing progression. This is PLOS in 2001. It had nothing to do with the Public Library of Science. They bought the domain in 2002, and this is where it was then, and this is, of course, where it is now. And the just incredible development of open access resources and facilities and initiatives that we now see come to fruition today, whether the Public Library of Science or, as we heard, the Open Medicine Project, the funders that have moved in this area as well in this country. This is IDRC, of course, and CIHR being a couple of good Canadian examples. The movement to digitize as well, the Google Book Search Program, or here in Canada, Alouette Canada, and the efforts to try to bring rise to more and more digital products or availability of digital content. And then, of course, the licenses that underlie so much of this, the Creative Commons Project, also just several years old, yet today with links to more than 200 million works and implementations in dozens of countries around the world. Now, that's part of Internet 2007, and that's the part you all know about. You probably know a lot about what I want to talk about here as well. But when we talk about policies, it's this, and it is frankly much more. It's the world of blogs. Technorati today cataloging 125,000 new blogs daily. Now, I'm sure there are plenty of those, I'm not sure, everybody knows, there are plenty of those that either die very quickly or, for that matter, aren't really worth reading. But for the most part, there is an amazing amount of stuff out there that is incredibly valuable, that is available almost exclusively by the blogosphere, which has given voice to, literally today, millions upon millions of people who now, using things like really simple syndication and blogging technology, who understand that if you can use a word processor, you too can run a blog and find audiences and ensure that your voice is heard and participate in broader debates. There's, of course, the social networking phenomenon, social media such as MySpace, an amazing story when it comes to the music world, but so too for those students in colleges and the like. There's the social media groups. This is Dig, and the big story that came out of Dig earlier. Dig's a site that allows people to identify news stories that they think are of interest. When enough people dig it, it moves to the front page, and thousands upon thousands of people view it. What happened a couple of months ago with Dig is people posted information about this little code, the 09F911 code. It's a code that can be used to break the encryption on high-definition DVDs. Publishing that code in some countries, the United States, is viewed as unlawful, as violating copyright law. And so the proprietors of Dig sought to take down these kinds of articles. But the community said, this is our community. And in our community, we don't believe that you stop the ability to publish that little, those few numbers of, those that collect that sentence of integers. And we're going to put it back up, which they did to the tune of 1 per second. And within a couple of hours, the Dig people simply gave up and recognized that as part of this phenomena, it's not just the people who run the websites, it's the communities themselves who really do become communities with interest and investment in them that often dictate what people will find online and discuss online. There's, of course, the audio equivalent to so much of this text, this being the iTunes page, where you can today find the audio equivalent with thousands of people engaging in podcasting and the like so that they can have their voice now literally heard by others. We see that in a whole range of places. Plug for my own institution, an experiment that we tried this past year within our law faculty was to podcast most of the first year law curriculum. And so every class was recorded and podcast, not just the lectures, but the questions themselves. And so it gave certainly the opportunity for some students who didn't want to show up the opportunity to hear what took place in the class. But the real result wasn't that people decided that they could skip class. They were still there. It gave them the opportunity to listen back and relive some of the debates around legal issues. And I perhaps most interestingly from our own, from our dean's perspective, was it gave the opportunity for a lot of people considering law school to figure out what it really was like to take Contracts 101. And so we had people from across the country listening literally on a weekly basis to what was taking place in Professor Ian Kerr's project or in property Professor De Beer's project and finding what law school was all about and either deciding to come or perhaps not, but making that knowledge available to many others outside the immediate classroom walls. There are sites that get less attention, but in many ways are no less important. There's Post Secret, for example. How many people here know of PostSecret? Okay, a few. which is great. So Post Secret was started about 2 years ago as essentially a community art project. And the idea was pretty simple. It's using, as you can see, off-the-shelf blogging software. And the idea here was post a secret. Send us something that you are willing to tell the world, but probably not your friends or your family, but you'll tell everybody because we'll provide you with the protection of anonymity here. Put it in the form of a postcard, make it artistic, do some sort of mashup or some sort of art, and tell the world something that, as I say, you might not be comfortable telling the people you're closest to. Last year, Post Secret had about 250,000 secrets sent to it. It has been the subject of 2 best-selling books and has appeared in art galleries throughout the United States. Every Sunday, there are a series of new secrets that get posted. And frankly, most of them are awfully sad. It's people who are dealing with drug addiction and failed relationships, abuses as a child and the like, and so this is their therapy. This is their way that they can share that with others and put it out within their art. It isn't copyright that implores them to do this. It isn't the incentives of copyright. It is simply the tools that we now have to do this and the ability to share, and as I say, 250,000 of these a year are taking place. There's the phenomena of online video. One example would be Star Trek, which is a Finnish film. There is, I suppose, somewhat unsurprisingly, an awful lot of Star Trek and Star Wars type online video. This would be one such example. This is a Finnish film that took 7 years to make, Star Trek, and it's actually pretty good. You can download it for free if you like. If you like it a lot, you can purchase the DVD, which contains a whole series of outtakes or t-shirts and the like. So that's the way they make money. So it's available freely, as I say, under a Creative Commons license. Within the 7 years, it's not just that the production values are quite good, but in the time that it has been released, the people behind this film have actually made back their money and more. They give their film away. They created it, as I say, over all these years using the basic off-the-shelf technologies that many of us have in our homes and offices. And yet, through a combination of upselling DVDs and actually licensing the film to some broadcast networks in certain countries, they've used that model to create and actually generate a profit. There's Elephant's Dream, a film from the Netherlands, which is billed as the world's first open film. Open not just because it is open in terms of being freely available. It's available, again, under a Creative Commons license, so it is free to download, but you can buy the DVD if you like. But open as well because the tools that were used to create this animated movie were free as well. Open source software, in this case Blender, was used to create these films, the tools themselves to create being free, the film itself being made freely available. There is, of course, the YouTube phenomena, which has all sorts of things, as you heard, including a couple of my own videos now. More interestingly for some, I suppose, would be things like Lonely Girl 15, which was the big debate last year. This girl sitting in a bedroom telling the world all sorts of things. Was this really a girl in her bedroom, or was this a professional film or a work of some professionals? It turned out that it actually was a scripted work of professionals. The girl here is actually an actress, so Lonely Girl was an actress from New Zealand. But yet I found that in many ways even more interesting because it suggests that there is a whole new way to distribute television in 2-minute segments freely on YouTube with more downloads than most cable television programs get, never mind the kind of ratings that some of the digital television networks get. And some of our television networks have begun to get this. And so this week I did release this movie, Putting Canadian Piracy in Perspective, and it's had lots of downloads on YouTube, which is great, but I've also posted it on this Exposure, which is a new CBC program that is going to debut in just a couple of weeks' time based solely on user-generated video. So they've invited people to post their own videos and rate and discuss, and they say they're going to take the best of the documentary films and the comedies and the like. And starting, I think it is on July 29th, there it is, July 29th, the show is going to premiere, and they're going to begin to show some of these. They've started off with a Sunday night at 11 time slot, such a great time slot. But nevertheless, if it's popular, we may well see this move earlier, I suppose, down the dial in terms of when it appears. But we're starting to see some of the broadcasters do this, and the CBC is, in a sense, only following what others have already done. This comes from the BBC, their Creative Archive License Group, with the tagline, find it, rip it, mix it, share it, come and get it, taking hundreds of hours of their content and making it freely available for others to remix and reuse. recognizing that particularly in the UK, where it is television taxpayers, as it were, who have funded this work, providing that work back into their hands to remix and reuse is, in a sense, only fair. There's, of course, Flickr, started out here, with today now more than 400 million pictures posted, more than 40 million of which are available under Creative Commons licenses. So that when you go to create your film, as I did with that Putting Piracy in Perspective, we've got a whole series of pictures posted in the film, all made freely available on Flickr, all using Creative Commons licenses, including the sorts of pictures that previously simply wouldn't have been available. We used pictures of a number of well-known musicians, the Bare Naked Ladies, Sarah McLachlan, Avril Lavigne, and they're all available on Flickr there too, where fans have taken those pictures and posted it and made it freely available to use. There is, of course, Wikipedia, which we all know, with now millions of articles posted in literally dozens of languages. While seemingly like clockwork, every few weeks you get an article in a local newspaper where someone has found an error in Wikipedia. Every day when I open up my local newspaper and turn to page A2, there are, of course, a series of corrections, so I don't think Wikipedia has a monopoly on mistakes. What it does have for many is just an incredible treasure trove of information that is, at a minimum, a terrific starting point for wherever your journey might lead. There are similar sorts of projects that have been launched, such as the Encyclopedia of Life, launched just over the last couple of months, seeking to catalog all 10 million species on our planet and do that in a freely available form over the next 10 years. There's the move towards citizen journalism, such as Oh My News, which for a period of time was one of Korea's most popular news sources, almost exclusively, almost all the stories that are generated on Oh My News, this being the English translation, but of course the main site in Korean, it created by individuals as part of the move towards citizen journalism. They employ a number of editors who call through that, but almost all the content you read is stuff created by the community. And there are similar sites, particularly for countries where we often wouldn't hear anything from a media perspective, but for online sources. Sources like the Global Voices site, which brings together bloggers and others from the global community, where stories from their communities never reach our ears but for sites like this. And then there's just a couple of other examples of what we see today. There's, of course, Project Gutenberg, this slide being slightly out of date, with now more than 19,000 books published in the public books in the public domain that have been digitized and made available. And Project Gutenberg Canada formally launched just on July 1st on Canada Day, just over 10 days ago. An offshoot of that is the LibriVox project, started out of Montreal, an attempt to provide audio versions of those same public domain books and do it in the same sort of user-generated form where individuals can take these books, read, and then record what they're reading and use that to generate MP3s. There we see an amazing array of things taking place from an educational community as well. The MIT OpenCourseWare initiative, perhaps most notable of among those. The effort 6 years ago, MIT announcing that they hoped within a decade to ensure that their syllabi and content would all be made freely available. You wouldn't get an MIT degree, but you would have access to that information. And earlier this year, MIT announcing that they were 4 years ahead of schedule and will complete this initiative this year. Now joined by dozens of universities from around the world, particularly from China, Japan, and France, though Canadian institutions have been very, very slow to jump on this. There's the Internet Archive, which I used to take some of those early 1997 slides, but they've got more than just that. They've got, for example, the Prelinger Archives, where Rick Prelinger has posted more than 2,000 videos that are in the public domain. And as part of Brewster Kahle, who runs the Internet Archives deal, if you have the rights to the video, or if there are no rights associated with the video, he'll host it for free forever. And so there are thousands of these films now, public domain films, that are freely available through the archive. And then, of course, underlying so much of this, whether your browser is Firefox or your email application is Thunderbird, your web server is Apache, which it most likely is, or your website was created using something like Joomla, which is the case in my case, so much of this content has been created through open source software tools, tools that are themselves freely available, created by the community. And it is not just sort of these peripheral, that what some might argue, peripheral stories of the grassroots development. We now see this within business and government as well. We see Dell, for example, adopting that dig-style approach where there's the opportunity for people to propose new changes to Dell products and then dig them or not as part of the so-called Dell idea storm and bring it to the attention of Dell executives, what people like or they don't like about some of their products. There's the way companies communicate with the public. When JetBlue, an airline in the United States, ran into serious trouble earlier this year and canceled almost a week's worth of flights out of JFK, the response was a YouTube video. A video from the CEO formally apologizing. I should note he's now been replaced as the CEO. So maybe it doesn't always work, but nevertheless, a YouTube video, a public declaration, and the use of the online forum to try to communicate, because that's where your customers are after all. We see it in government as well. This website comes from our own Governor General, the Citizen Voices website, because our Governor General, it turns out, is a blogger. So she's got online chat and the opportunity for people to post comments and blog-type commentary on the Citizen Voices site. There is efforts to try to use these same tools too as part of the policy-making process. Last fall, I appeared before the Federal Trade Commission as part of their three days of hearings on consumer protection over the next 10 years online. They actually launched a blog and gave the opportunity for some of the people who would appear as witnesses to post and answer questions, and then provided some of that discussion in advance of the hearings to the various FTC commissioners. In the UK, 10 Downing Street has gone even further. They've actually launched an e-petitions website. And so that anyone in the UK can go to the Prime Minister of the Prime Minister's website and launch their own petition on whatever issue they think is important. And if enough of their fellow citizens say, we think it's important too, it's going to generate some attention. And indeed, on issue after issue, the government has seen fit at least to respond, even if to say that this is not an issue that's a high priority right now. It is certainly a new way to communicate, a new way to ensure that you are dealing with and actively involving the public in this new participatory internet. Well, that's Internet 2007. And I must say I have a real concern from a policy perspective that when our policymakers talk about where they're going, they think not about this, but rather about Internet 1997, what the internet looked like 10 years ago and what technology facilitated 10 years ago. Those things have changed really dramatically. But what we have to be thinking about, I would argue, is not just what takes place today, but where we are headed, Internet 2017, for that 11th annual conference, for that next 10 years of where all of this may take us. And that's where I want to make the argument that there is an opportunity for this community to recognize that open access is absolutely necessary, but is not wholly sufficient. I want to focus on, in particular, on four pillars that I think we ought to be focusing on. First off, content. And obviously, open access is a crucial part of this. The ability for people, as we all know, to have access, whether it is to new scientific knowledge or other sorts of knowledge, knowledge that in many instances has been funded, has been paid for by the public itself, is absolutely essential and indeed ought to be one of the core principles in any sort of information society, in any strategy from a government that seeks to ensure that all Canadians have connectivity, but not necessarily ensure that all Canadians have access. We must change that, and clearly that's part of the story. But even within content, I don't think it's all of the story. There's Crown copyright. The fact that still today, for government documents, we still have to ask for permission to use those government documents. I did a piece fairly recently that talked about what it would take for someone to create, a YouTube video, and they want to use a little bit of stuff from the House of Commons. Let's say you were doing a video on environmental issues, and you wanted to have some of the exchange from the House of Commons involving the Environment Minister John Baird. If you want to use some of those clips, the rules actually tell you, particularly if you want to use it, say, for parody purposes, since many would argue the policies are somewhat laughable, you can't just take those clips and simply use them. You actually have to go to the Speaker of the House of Commons and ask for permission to use those clips. And the Speaker of the House actually reserves the right, certainly, to refuse permission. One would imagine, particularly if you seek to parody the Speaker of the House. Now, it's not just that you have to ask for permission, but indeed the House of Commons itself has at times been aggressive about taking down content where people have used some of those clips, say from committee hearings, in ways they don't like. So someone from the CBC about a year or so ago created a video where the CBC president, Rabinovich, was appearing before a House of Commons committee, and they did a voiceover, which, depending on your sense of humor, you either found rather humorous or rather silly, but nevertheless was a clear case of parody of the CBC president and a number of MPs questioning him. And yet, if you try to find that video on YouTube today, and you'll find places where there are references to it, and you click through to YouTube, you find that it has been taken down. The rights holder argued that it was a case of copyright infringement. The rights holder was the House of Commons. And the House of Commons said that that form of political speech somehow violated their rights as copyright holders. And it's not just for video, it's for text as well. I've actually launched an access to information request to try to get a better handle on just how many requests there are. Amazingly, the database software that the government uses to catalog these requests is so out of date that they can't provide me with the list. And so I said, okay, provide me simply with all the records and I'll generate my own list. I actually spoke to the person responsible just yesterday who informed me that just last year, because we've narrowed it just down to last year, there are 9,000 instances of requests for Crown copyright documents just in the federal government alone, generating 63,000 documents. So it's a little much for me to actually have to go through. So we're going to have to find a different way to deal with the issue. But the larger point is here that literally 9,000 times last year, people had to go to their government to ask for permission to use government-related works, works that the public itself has paid for and that I would argue in many respects ought to be freely available. The same is true for public broadcasters. So while it is great that the CBC is running this thing such as exposure, the reality is, for the overwhelming majority of CBC content today, it is locked down, and if it is made available, it's often made available using a Microsoft DRM product, and so it isn't even made available to those who are looking to use it on alternative software platforms outside Microsoft Windows. Certainly, that's even just for basic access, for reuse and the like. It's almost a total non-starter with the CBC. And this comes in stark contrast to other public broadcasters who have increasingly recognized that there is a role for them to play in this environment. Whether it's the BBC facilitating the kind of mashup that I described earlier, the NBC, not the NBC in the United States, but rather the Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation, which makes weeks of its content freely available online as a sort of internet-based VCR, or ABC, not the US-based ABC, but the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, who during copyright reform hearings a year or so ago dealing with digital rights management and anti-circumvention stepped forward and said that they feared that the proposed legislation would interfere and make it impossible to meet their legislative mandate of ensuring that the Australian people had access to Australian stories and Australian culture, as they feared it would be locked down using these DRM systems. There is a role to play for our public broadcasters here as well when we think about what content can look like 10 years from now. There is connectivity, for if the content is available but people don't have connectivity, they still don't have access to that content. And under this branch, we can think of a whole range of issues. We can think, for example, of broadband. We had a year or so ago the Telecom Review Panel, which took a look at telecom policy in Canada and reached the conclusion that even with the most aggressive of scenarios, one in which you believe that the market can solve just about everything, there are still going to be 5% of Canadians who, under the rosiest of scenarios, will not have access to high-speed networks. They will simply be shut out of this environment. And we have to recognize that for so much of this, access, high-speed access, is the price of admission. If you don't have that access, it's not just that you don't have access, but you can't even participate. Because when we think of the ways that you can participate, so much of it is indeed premised on having that kind of access. And so there must surely be a role for government to play here to ensure that there is access for all. Our Telecommunications Act says as its first objective is for Canadians to have access to telecommunications infrastructure. We must change that to say it's to have access to advanced telecommunications infrastructure, and the advanced being the focus on ensuring that everybody has access to broadband. But it isn't even just broadband. It's increasingly the number of municipalities and others recognizing that access ought to be a basic right and is certainly something that one can engage in as almost a utility an article actually out today from Regina talking about their efforts. The largest free Wi-Fi system run right now in the country is in Regina, where that whole community, or much of that community today, has free access, and we are seeing that in Fredericton and in a range of other communities across the country, and I think there was a role for many other municipalities to think about the same issues. There's the net neutrality issues, which is, if you haven't focused on yet, you must. Net neutrality focuses on the issue where internet service providers have, in some instances, the economic incentives to discriminate against certain forms of content. So if you are an ISP that also happens to own a television network or a radio network, you might allow that their content, the content that you happen to own, to run on their high-speed networks and relegate the rest of the content that many of us might create, or the diversity of voices that we seek, to run on the slower networks. In the United States, there's been a lot of focus on this net neutrality issue, with even some proposals for legislative change. In Canada, the issue hasn't gotten near the same amount of traction, despite the fact that from a media consolidation perspective, we are in many ways even more consolidated than they are in the United States. And so when we talk about the leading internet service providers in the country, like Rogers and Videotron and Cogeco, we are also talking about the leading radio companies, sometimes the leading print companies, and sometimes the leading television companies as well. And indeed, we have had incidents, here in this area, here in TELUS, of course, one of the leading providers, an incident just a couple of years ago where they were in a dispute with their union, and a site that was supportive of that union was blocked by TELUS. Blocked not just for its residential customers, but for anyone who was buying at a wholesale level internet service. So the city of Prince Rupert, which runs a municipal ISP, found that their connectivity to this site was blocked. But it wasn't just that site. Along the way, TELUS blocked more than 600 other websites, all located on the same IP address, including one site devoted to breast cancer research. Now, that's one such example, but there are others. In my own house, I use Rogers back in Ottawa. They engage in something known as traffic shaping, where they shape down, they limit the amount of bandwidth that is made available for certain kinds of applications. They do that, for example, say for BitTorrent, to try to cut down on the use of BitTorrent. Yet increasingly, from the academic community and others, videos of lectures and the like are distributed through torrents. And so our students, when they try to access that from off campus, find that they can't because Rogers has cut down the amount of bandwidth available to them. Unless we actually create legislative provisions to ensure that ISPs can't do this, they can, and they have made pretty clear that they will. And so this is an issue if you are worried about ensuring that once you've made the material available under open access, it is actually accessible. Then there's the spectrum auction, an issue that is going to come up over the next number of months, where the government is auctioning off some new spectrum and debating whether or not to create a set-aside so that we might get another cell phone provider and deal again with this issue of ensuring that there is a sufficient amount of competition and not the incentives to limit the amount of bandwidth that is made readily available. So connectivity remains, in my view, a core issue for this community as well as, I think, for the public as a whole. We can do more to enhance participation. We've seen the amazing tools that the internet provides from the perspective of enhancing participation, but there is more to be done. A particular issue for me surrounds internet intermediary liability concerns. The potential for liability for those that sit in the middle, sometimes not for what they say, but rather for simply providing a forum for others to speak. Now, in the United States, there is actually a legislative provision that provides immunity for intermediaries. So if you are Amazon and you provide the ability for people to do book reviews, those book reviews are written by third parties, and it's not Amazon that's held responsible. If you're Google and you offer up a blogging platform, the comments that are made on those blogs are the responsibility of the bloggers, not of Google. If you're eBay and you allow for people to provide feedback on sellers, the responsibility for those comments and the feedback is the responsibility of the people who post the feedback, not eBay. And if you're an individual blogger who posts some content and people comment on it, your responsibility starts, of course, with what you've said. But when there are third-party comments, the responsibility there lies with the third party, not with the original blogger. Now, that's not the case here. And so when large companies, large and frankly small companies, receive a notification alleging that there is some defamatory content, unproven at this stage, on their website, their response invariably is to take it down. Why? Because the risk of following through is a risk of liability. I should tell you that I'm being sued, actually here in BC, by someone by the name of Wayne Crooks, who was involved with, since I'm being sued, I won't comment on the name, a Green Party organizer who is not suing just me, but he's been actually suing Google and suing a range of other parties. In my instance, he's suing me both for comments on my blog, not anything that I ever said, but rather someone else said a comment on one of my postings, as well as for my blog role, because I posted a link to a website called P2PNet, which in turn linked to another website which contained an allegedly defamatory article. And he's arguing that makes me a republisher of the libel, two steps removed. It's sort of the Kevin Bacon school of law. So it's just two degrees of separation. But for anybody who links to my website, be on guard, because you never know. And so that's the reality. And I actually did take down the allegedly defamatory posting, but I didn't do it quick enough for Mr. Crooks. And so the lawsuit continues. And while there were a number of people who said, great, they're suing the guy who knows all about this stuff. Truth of the matter is, even just to try to get much of this stricken, will run into the thousands of dollars. And it's not just me who knows something about these issues. There are lots of other people who face the same sorts of lawsuits. That's the kind of chill that we need to address in this country, one that has been addressed elsewhere, as I say, in the United States, but not here. We need to think about what our domain name system looks like for those that English is not their first language. The issue of internationalized domain names where people can use their own native characters, whether French accents or others, is one that we have been incredibly slow to deal with. And I say this knowing that I spent 6 years on the board of the Canadian Internet Registration Authority, which manages the .ca domain. Yet for whatever reason, it was never enough of a priority to move forward. The same is true at the international level, where still years after debate, years indeed after a commitment to address this issue so that people around the world can use domain names in their own native character, this issue still has not been addressed. And from an access perspective, what could be more important than the ability to have access to your own language when it comes to something such as a domain name system? We need to think about privacy-related issues, one that for a whole emerging generation who now is growing up on things like Facebook, is an issue that is often secondary and often not even thought about. It was my birthday on Wednesday, and I have a Facebook page. And amongst the settings, unbeknownst to me, I didn't look carefully enough, was my birth date. And so, much to my surprise, I kept getting all these emails from people wishing me a happy birthday, including someone who knew this was happening and said, you must really love getting all these emails. And it was just a simple fact that for many people, that information is readily available, sometimes with their knowledge, often without. And yet our privacy legislation that exists in our country today does in many instances very little to address this issue. Indeed, if someone collects information and they are located outside the country, we had one case where the privacy commissioner even refused to investigate the case, arguing that they simply didn't have jurisdiction to try to deal with this issue. And in that instance, we actually launched a lawsuit to compel her to investigate. And yet our privacy legislation can do more. So too with people's confidence in their ability to communicate online with things like spam and spyware, where increasingly for many people they are simply turning away from these forms of communication as under the onslaught of the junk mail that they receive. And finally, for those that know the stuff I talk about, unsurprisingly, the fourth pillar would be copyright. And there are lots of issues that I think we ought to be focusing on here as well. First and foremost, it is anti-circumvention legislation, which in a sense is legislation that provides legal protection for digital locks, for digital rights management. And so if we think of copyright law providing a first layer of protection for people that create works, DRM, digital rights management, provides a second level of protection because you can lock down that content using technology. Anti-circumvention legislation provides yet another layer. It actually provides protection for the digital locks themselves so that someone who seeks to pick the lock can be guilty of infringement even if the underlying work itself is not infringing or their use of that underlying work is not infringing. That's the state of the law in the United States with legislation known as the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and there is every reason to believe that we will see similar legislation introduced here in Canada early in the fall. Everyone you talk to in Ottawa says this has now become enough of a priority that we will see this kind of legislation in place. The problem here is that we know, based particularly on the US experience, what some of the consequences might be. Think, for example, of a Princeton professor, Ed Felton. Felton is best known, he's a computer security researcher. He's best known for a case that arose a number of years ago where the recording industry launched a contest to see if someone could break their latest form of encryption known as SDMI. And Professor Felton, together with a number of grad students, did so in fairly short order. Yet when he went to try to release his findings, because that's what computer security researchers do, he received a threatening letter from the recording industry saying they would sue for copyright infringement if he disclosed the fruits of his research. Now, they actually backed off when Felton got more aggressive and sort of said, you know, if you want to challenge me, I'll take you on. Yet the story doesn't end there. I was at a conference with Professor Felton about a year ago, and he advised, which for me was rather astonishing, that for every 2 hours that he spends in the lab working on computer security research, he spends 1 hour talking to Princeton legal counsel. Now, I'm all for talking to lawyers, but when our security researchers spend a third of their time talking about what they can or cannot disclose, there's a real problem. Felton went on to say that talk about the Sony rootkit case, a case that you may recall from a year or so ago, where Sony surreptitiously inserted on their CDs from a whole range of artists copy protection that created a vulnerability within people's computers. It opened you up to the prospect of hacks and otherwise and other harms. They all eventually faced all sorts of class action litigation and the like, and infected hundreds of thousands of computers along the way. Now, all of this was disclosed when a blogger, Mark Russinovich, who was also involved in computer security, posted on this on Halloween Day. And it slowly gained some traction, and the story went from there. What Felton told me was that he knew about this months earlier, and yet didn't disclose it because he was too busy negotiating with Princeton legal counsel about what he could or could not disclose. There are the fair use concerns that we have in this country, the gift of a Supreme Court that has said we have fair dealing and to interpret that in a broad and liberal manner, yet it is still limited to a narrow series of categories, things like research and private study, news reporting and criticism. So if one wants to engage, say, in parody, it isn't covered by our fair dealing provision in the way that it would be under fair use. There is still the prospect of term extension. The US and Europe and some other countries have extending the term of copyright from life of the author plus 50 years to life of the author plus 70, and we still face enormous pressure. I was on a panel just last week in Ottawa where I was told by a representative of one of the writers' unions how the life plus 50 was at a time when people weren't living as long, and it was clear that we needed to extend the term of copyright. This is an issue that isn't going away. And when it comes back again, the prospect that 20 years worth of work will suddenly be taken away, the prospect that some in the US argue they will see nothing come back into the public domain, as there will simply be an extension after extension after extension, is a real one. I'm getting the signal that I need to wrap up soon, so quickly on the other two. There is the issue of orphan works, the enormous amount of content, frankly the largest block of content, for which we often cannot find the underlying author, and we need systems to ensure that people can use that work in an appropriate fashion, representing an enormous challenge. And then there's what takes place at the international level, at the World Intellectual Property Organization at WIPO. Had another, sort of one other interesting story, at least for me, was during negotiations just last month for the Access to Knowledge Treaty, I received an email from someone in Geneva who advised that the Canadian government was one of the barriers to reaching agreement on this issue, and they were actually arguing against inclusion of the words access to knowledge as being one of the goals within the World Intellectual Property Organization. Now, the tools allow us today to actually reach out, and I sent an email back to this person because this was in real time. I said, who was it that said this? And you know, what exactly did they say? And they said, not only did they has the delegation said this, but they actually said they consulted you on it. And I was sort of rather amazed and sent an email to this person, you know, did you really say this? She said, no, we didn't really say that we consulted you on this particular issue. We consulted you more generally on copyright and our stance here at WIPO. And yet when I asked back and said, can you give me one example when you've consulted either me or frankly anyone on our position on the development agenda, I've yet to receive a response. And so what our government does internationally on these sorts of issues becomes important as well. And so when I argue that open access is absolutely necessary, I also want, as I say, make the argument that I think it is not sufficient. I think all of these issues are part of this story as well, and a story that this community is well placed to get engaged with. Now, to conclude, when I think about what we take a look at today in Internet 2007 and think about where we may be headed with Internet 2017, I think it's important that we all recognize that that view from back in 97, the hands-off the Internet view, that government being too Luddite and of staying away, simply isn't the right one. It isn't about hands-off the Internet. It's about recognizing that the future of the Internet is in our hands. Thanks very much for your attention.